You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Tuesday, we're privileged to be joined by a Mustang, Ben Connable. Ben, first of all, probably been a little bit too long. How are you? Good to hear your voice.
Good. Good, Mac. Thanks for having me on again.
No, I'm curious, as the Trump administration continues, do you, like the rest of us, chuckle when the world gets a chance to see the intellect and the leadership abilities of the guys that we served with, Mattis, Kelly, Dunford? General Mattis, when asked at West Point,
are
what
you
keeps
looking
you up
for
at night,
the perfect gift for somebody who's
without
pause
and
for first
with absolute sincerity responds, nothing, I keep other people awake at night. I don't know if you saw that. It was awesome, though.
I did not see that. That's classic.
Check out Face the Nation from 8 days ago. And it's about a 30-minute interview. It's a quality interview. But I think somewhere in the middle he gets asked that. And it's a matter-of-fact statement, right? You shared that with the rest of us. I think it's great that the world gets to see guys committed to the nation, not to a political party, and not afraid to tell the truth. It's certainly a little bit different.
I'm glad you're there. Without a doubt.
All right, first of all, Ben and I are battle buddies times two. Ben, tell everybody, give them a little bit of your background for those people who don't know you. Go ahead. I'll get out of your way here.
Sure, yeah, I'm fire enlisted. I was a machine gunner, and then I went through the MESAP program. I was commissioned. I was an intel officer, a Middle East foreign area officer. I retired in 2009, and I've been at RAND ever since. I did three tours in Iraq, and I was in the Gulf War.
All right. The machine gun question for you first. Machine gun is an indirect fire weapon. Is that a ridiculous notion, or could you guys actually hit something on the backside of a hill?
Such a World War One notion where they used to have machine gun battalions in the tables. They still existed when I first came in, and I was publicly humiliated by a company commander one time who challenged me to recite the machine gun tables. And when I couldn't, he said, "You're not a machine gunner," and walked away. So it doesn't sound ridiculous to me. I still sweat when I think about that.
So I want to publicly apologize for bringing up such a personally traumatic incident in your past. So please accept my personal apology for opening up that wound. You would think after all these years, maybe it would go away.
I wouldn't want to, let's just put it this way, I wouldn't want to be in the receiving end of a 40 machine gun beating zone,
right,
direct or otherwise, yeah.
Okay. Did you have a favorite machine gun that you were able to, I mean, I'm sure you, like most machine gunners, you had exposure to a few of them. Did you have a favorite?
Yeah, 50 cal is by far the best. Yeah, there's no comparison. As long as you have to carry it, it's marvelous.
All right. Have we solved the whole, I read the other day that we don't have to set headspace and timing anymore. They've taken that out of the equation, but did you do well at that? And did you have an actual gauge, or did you use an MRE spoon or something else?
With the actual gauge. No, I'm not claiming any real expertise. You know, I was in an actual, heavy guns unit for a short period of time. Those guys could run circles around me.
All right. Let's talk about, first of all, general situation stuff. Can you give us, before we talk about specifics, can you give us a general situation, first of all, about Mosul and the fight? And then after you do that, I want to talk about everything outside of that. How is Mosul going?
Yeah, we've talked about this in previous discussions. I mean, you can see now that the noose is tightening around the remaining pockets on the west side of the river. It is an intense tactical fight. The ISIL guys are not giving up. They're continuing to use vehicle bombs. They're continuing to pop up behind the Iraqi army front lines. But I think, you know, on the positive side, the Iraqi army, the divisions that are there, the federal police forces that are there, the Iraqi SOF and CTS forces, all seem to be holding up pretty well and performing well. I think the best news might be that the Iraqi army divisions are at least functioning and, you know, they haven't broken. They're continuing to advance. I think the question on the back, there are two questions on the back end. Is one, you know, can they replicate this kind of offensive activity without ISOF and CTS running around and up front? And then two, what are they going to do when the last round is fired? I don't think that's going to happen. You know, they'll still be fighting, but they're not in any way prepared to conduct civil military operations that I've seen, or that, you know, based on my conversations with folks who are closer to the fight than, you know, Washington D.C. And so I don't see a plan in place to deal with that. They are right now already overwhelmed by a lot of the refugee issues. A lot of the people who just fled Mosul are going to want to go right back in, and they're going to have to try to prevent that because there are going to be IEDs all over the place, and services are not going to be there. So the post-fight is going to be really tough at the tactical level, but strategically it's critically important, because if Mosul looks like a battlefield a year from now and people are still displaced, Iraq is in big trouble.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about, you were involved in a group here recently. Can you explain to everybody what you were involved in?
Yeah, I was invited to participate with the Atlantic Council's Task Force on the Future of Iraq, led by former Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who's a magnificent ambassador and a great guy to travel with, I have to say. Unbreakable will. He was capable of doing 12 to 14-hour days and being in the lead all the time, so I was really impressed with him. We traveled to Iraq. We were guests of the Prime Minister, but we also went and spoke with governors and local politicians and did a whole bunch of other engagements. We were in Jordan speaking to tribal leaders. We just published a report. It's Ryan's report. We were, you know, random contributors. And that came out of the Atlantic Council a couple of days ago.
So talk to us about the future of Iraq. You just when you were talking about Mosul and you began to talk about the aftermath, the things you said made me very uncomfortable, almost like we're going to do this again. So take us through what happens, the future of Iraq. What is it?
Yeah, I think this also brings up a much bigger challenge for the United States, and it's something that I've discussed in a report that I just published. I agree with a lot of the points that that Ambassador Crocker brings up, argue for a longer-term look and a long-term U.S. presence in Iraq. We keep trying to pull out or reduce our footprint in order to prevent getting pulled back in, and I think it's time to admit that we're going to be there for a while and stay, and I think we'd be far more effective if we did that. I think we're far more likely to just get to watch collapse after collapse and return after return if we don't really commit ourselves here. So that's the argument that Ambassador Crocker makes. I think you see the fault lines already appearing, and if there's nobody there from the outside to help manage the violence or the prospective violence along the Green Line in Kirkuk, in Mosul, if we don't deal with the damage that's been done to the Sunni areas in Anbar and Saladin and Nineveh, you're going to see them reorganize, not under the Islamic State banner, but under other banners, and start to come back again. The other thing that exacerbates that is the real possibility that the Iranians are going to be able to complete what is being called a land bridge to Syria through the Iraqi border, which would connect them all the way from Iran to Lebanon. If that's the case, that road runs right through Anbar province, and I'm sure you've traveled that road a few times, and through Syria, through Sunni areas of Syria. We will just see perpetual violence and shakeups, political shakeups, that are not going to be in our favor. So it's time to get back in there and do something about this.
Ben Connerville, from RAND, my guest this morning, a retired Marine Corps officer. Crocker is a political guy. In addition to, you know, he lives in he straddles two worlds. How does it do that? There's already discussion. I want to say, I don't know if it was a post this morning or yesterday, talked about that President Trump is bumping up against President Obama's political conundrum in Afghanistan, which is his political people are telling him that it's a liability. The only thing he can do is lose votes by it, and he has his military people, State Department people telling him you can't leave. How do we navigate both those worlds?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you had, you know, President Obama came in having campaigned on a withdrawal from Afghanistan and had left himself very little room to maneuver once he came into office. So he was almost, you know, that what happened during the Obama administration was almost preordained during the campaign. President Trump was less vocal about Afghanistan during the campaign. I think he has more wiggle room here. But because we've been unable to do anything there, and because we set what I think are the wrong expectations for withdrawal, people have set those expectations in their own minds as well. They think we should be getting out of there, and they actually think we're behind schedule, the ones who still remember that we have troops in Afghanistan. I'm not sure there are many Americans left who do other than those who have brothers, sons, sisters, et cetera. So I think he could make a commitment there. I don't think it would cost him much politically at all. I don't think a few thousand extra troops is going to even break squelch right now with all of the other things going on. But those troops, if they come with a strategy, would be quite helpful. That's the problem we're really facing in Afghanistan right now, is we don't really have a strategy. The one singular objective, strategic objective that we had for the war beginning in 2001, that lasted all the way through the Bush and Obama administrations, was the removal of al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and the prevention of its return. Unfortunately, that has failed. Al-Qaeda is in southeastern Afghanistan, and you're seeing the rise of, you know, small elements of the Islamic State there as well. So, if that remains our strategic objective, then we need to do something more about that. I would argue that that's probably insufficient. That might be for another place in time. At the very least, we can keep the Afghan state from collapsing. We can probably prevent things like Sangin from falling, where General Kelly's son was killed. I'm sure that was a very bitter moment for him when Sangin District Center fell. Yeah. Does that mean another 20,000 troops? No, but it means not unpartnering before the job is done.
How is the model that we have used in and around Mosul, as the United States says, and I know this started with General Allen putting together a task force to look at the issue for then-President Obama. Is the model that we're seeing in and around Mosul the model for American forces in the region going forward, which is, because knowing that the American public is not so much about watching funerals and seeing casualties come home, is it to advise, stabilize, and backstop? Do you see that as the role relative to a sustained presence for us, Ben?
It looks like it. I don't agree with it, but I think that does look like the model that we're going to apply now. It looks like the one we're about to apply in Raqqa, Syria, where we're arming and preparing the Kurds to go into a city of 250,000 people. I'm not sure they're ready for that at the same level that the Iraqi army was ready for Mosul. Right. Admittedly, Raqqa is a smaller city, but this is the heart of the caliphate. So they're going to have a tough time there. More importantly, again, in Raqqa, just as in Mosul, there's no way that the Kurds are going to be able to handle a post-conflict stabilization. So, and in all likelihood, their presence in Raqqa will just lead to more violence. There are four big tribes around there. They're Bedouin. You know, I mean, this is not a good place to inject even an internal force that's not, you know, it's not local. So it's a bad operational plan, I think, and I think it's also a really bad strategic plan. There is no strategy right now, really, in Syria except to destroy, actually now it's annihilate, the Islamic State. There's no plan for the long run. There's no plan for what happens next. There's no plan for how to deal with what happens if ISIL splits, or what happens if most of the guys in the Islamic State change hats and go over to the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, or what happens if they, you know, they just decide to change their name because it's easier, and, or et cetera, right? So you see all of these permutations can very quickly kick the legs out from underneath the this idea that we're going to annihilate a large hybrid terrorist insurgent group. I don't see how that's possible. I don't think annihilate is any different from defeat or destroy. I don't think any of those words really have any meaning absent some kind of logical strategic context.
You talked about you don't agree that you know, advising backstopping is the appropriate strategy. Give me a better strategy that certainly, if you would articulate it, I'm sure it's linked to our strategic goals in the region. So give me a better way.
Well, I'd like to know what our strategic goals in the region are, too. You know, I can point to a couple of documents that say there are democratic stability across the whole region, signed by the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
If that's the case, then we should be doing a whole range of other things that we're not doing, political things, focusing on reconciliation.
Right.
At the local level in Syria, what I recommended was the creation of safe zones. I've had some very qualified people tell me that that's never going to happen, and they may very well be right. But the idea is to get some leverage against the Russians to change the Assad regime. The only way we're going to get any Syrians to work with us over the long run is to change the regime there, and then eventually they can help us turn against the radical Islamists. Right now, what's happening is that because we're forcing them to deal with the fact that Assad's going to stay, and asking them to fight against the Islamic State when they really want to fight against Assad, a lot of them are switching sides and joining the Al-Qaeda affiliate, and some of them are joining ISIL. So our strategy is actually undermining our tactical approach. That's one of the reasons it's so important to have a strategy as you execute a military operation.
Does it surprise you? We both know that the Secretary of Defense, that we continue down this road without, because to be honest with you, this thing that's headed towards Raqqa seems like it's on autopilot. And for those who don't have Google Earth, if you looked at where Raqqa is not, you know, San Diego, Tijuana, okay, from Iraq or Mosul or anything close to Iraq. Raqqa is a ways into Syria, okay? And so under this guise of destroy ISIS, I mean, we're essentially, you know, invading Syria. That has not been either. I'll tell you that I was moderately disturbed, and I continue to be, that we'll be fighting in Syria, and we already are, without any kind of, I don't know, proclamation, any kind of action by Congress, or any kind of national discussion about where this is all heading. What do you make of that, Ben? Why not? I mean, the one time I saw was at a Senate Armed Service Committee, and it was General Vogel, if you will, and he got asked, he said, well, it's simply a continuation of the mandate that we have to be in Iraq. Your thoughts on that kind of bowl of spaghetti of strategy, no articulated vision, no American debate, and yet we continue down that road?
It seems like a recipe for disaster,
yes,
to me. And I think if you look back in history at the conflicts in which, you know, there were no strategies or poorly thought through strategies, those tended not to end well for the side that failed to think it through. Strategies change. War is dynamic. You have to be flexible and adaptable and all these things, but you have to at least have an idea of what it is you want to accomplish. Destroying a group is not a strategy. certainly when you're thinking about an incredibly complex country like Syria. I don't buy that our presence in Syria follows logically from our presence in Iraq. It seems like, yes, there are crossover points there that are very obvious, but it's a different country. It's a far more complex one, and it's one in which we are working against the government, not with the government, you know, not directly, but indirectly. Right. So that's a completely different problem set in a lot of ways, and we are there, as you point out. We have hundreds, if not well over 1,000, I don't know the exact number of troops there right now. We only have about 4,500 in Iraq and same, you know, about twice that many in Afghanistan. So as you look at where we are in combat around the world, maybe there's some guys in the Philippines and other places, Syria might be the third biggest, and it's certainly one of, if not the single most intense. So I don't understand how we don't have a strategy other than to say nobody has been willing to take the risk to articulate one. Because if you articulate a strategy, then you have to do something about it. And that would mean taking risk. It would mean not necessarily confronting Russia with force, but confronting Russia politically. It would mean confronting the Assad regime politically. It would mean expending money and resources and, you know, and building a real coalition to go in there and do something about this. But I think it's worth thinking about what we should do there in much greater detail. If you think about the one event, the one war that has done more to destabilize the world in the last few years, I don't think it's Iraq, and I don't think it's, and pick your war around the world. I can't list them all here. Syria. The Syrian refugees that have come out of that battle, that come out of that disaster, have changed the face of Europe because they have dragged with them refugees from all over the world who have seen the doors opening, right? And so that has changed the way Europeans think about the Middle East and about humanity. It's changed the way we think about other people. It has changed our sense of security. So I don't understand how anybody could make the argument. Well, I have difficulty understanding how anybody could make the argument that we don't have a strategic interest in stabilizing Syria.
Would you be surprised, again, knowing the principles involved, if as Mosul winds itself down and we pivot to Raqqa, we're already pivoting, by the way, but as we do the public pivot to Raqqa, if there isn't one articulated?
I'm sorry?
We know the principles involved, and these guys have told us always about strategy. Right. I mean, strategy is the architecture, and you'll hear General Mattis talk about it, Secretary Mattis talk about it in speeches wherever he goes. Will you be surprised if we in this pivot to Raqqa, prior to publicly heading in that direction? I say publicly because we're already shaping it now. Will you be surprised if he doesn't come out and articulate a strategy and an end state? Because that certainly would not be his style.
No, I won't be surprised. And without getting into national politics, I think it would be very hard right now for the president to expend the time and effort to think about this in great detail. Secretary Mattis in January issued, or actually it was President Trump, I'm assuming Mattis or somebody else wrote it, but a national security directive stating that there would be a counter-ISIL plan in place within 30 days. Now, right. That to me, that should have read stabilization of the Middle East plan, but fine. That plan is not in place, and I think the political situation and the complexity of the global environment have delayed them. It seems very similar to what happened under the last administration.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to look over the horizon and look at Iraq, and Ben's going to give us his estimate of the situation. More of All Marine Radio. Our second year, by the way, Carnival. How about that?
That's fantastic, Matt. Congrats.
Thanks. More of this program coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled machine anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with a serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. Ben Carnival, former Marine officer, currently a RAND guy. And so even if it is B.B. King and you two, I've got no time for that right now. Your time with Ambassador Crocker, you're looking at those issues that that are so difficult. What do you see in the future? Do you see something emerging? Do you see more smoke in the room? Is it as murky as it has been? Give us a glimpse over the horizon.
It was murky, yeah. I think, you know, when we were doing our work and going out and talking to Iraqis and listening to them, it was clear that they were already thinking past the Islamic State. That was not their primary concern. Their primary concerns were political, how do they deal with the Iranian influence inside the country, to include even the politicians who leaned, who were Shia politicians who were influenced by Iran or had to deal with Iranian influence. They were still concerned about how that was going to play out. The Sunni obviously, destroyed most of them. I don't know if it's most, but a significant number of them are displaced internally, and their cities are destroyed. How are they going to rebuild and rebound from that? And then how do you deal with what may be 100,000, probably less, Shia Hashim Shabi militiamen who now are effectively part of the government and that have enormous political power and really represent a partial removal of control of the you know, power from the state, the use of force from the state. And that's a dangerous condition. So they're concerned about it. I think when the president went to the Middle East and really kind of put a flag down on the Sunni side of the world, that gave a lot of Sunni Arabs who are concerned about Iran a lot of hope that, that the U.S. was going to side with them. That is a, it reinforces a kind of black and white worldview applied to the Middle East. On the negative side, I can see that it kind of cuts out any opportunity to deal with Iran other than through force or subversion or other, forceful economic measures. But perhaps on the positive side, it could help coalesce the Sunni. Certainly the Iraqi Sunni that I spoke with were really hopeful after that speech, and they think the U.S. is going to come in to rescue them. So two things. I don't think the U.S. is going to come in to rescue them. So then we are perhaps setting up a cycle of disappointment here that could lead to further violence down the road. And then second, there are already signs of Sunni disunity, or at least kind of a concentration of power around very specific Gulf countries. You may have seen the report this morning that five Gulf countries split away from Qatar. Not terribly surprising based on previous relationships, but that's troubling. And, you know, what does that mean for being able to form a coalition of countries that are going to help us stabilize the Middle East or continue to support our operations there? I don't know. We have a base in Qatar, and we also have a base in Bahrain, and we conduct operations with the UAE, and we support the Saudi military. So we're now supporting countries that are basically not in contact anymore. It's a tough position to be in. It makes it harder to envision a way in which we get more deeply involved in Iraq to help stabilize the country.
What you just described for me is I hear General Zinni talking. He said, sometimes, you can't envision it where you are today, and you have to get there. And as you move into one place, as you move into one phase, the next phase becomes more clear. What are the things that have to be clarified in order for Iraq to make progress? Because to me, it sounds like I don't. Do you know Grant Newsham?
No.
He's a Pacific Rim guy, an intel guy. I thought you may have crossed paths with him. Anyway, China is offering Saipan, resort hotels, tourist development, yada yada yada, in exchange for just saying no to American military bases in that part of the Pacific. The problem is it's dancing with the devil. It sounded like the same thing relative to the Iranian president's presence in Iraq, even for members of the Shia sect. How do they navigate that? Did you give it away already? Almost like the drug lords look at Mexico. What do you mean you're taking it back? We own it. You can't do that. How does that smoke get out of the room, and how does that clear so they can make progress as a nation?
With the Iranians, you have to admit or at least agree with the fact that the Iranians have a legitimate interest in Iraq. Iraq tried to carve away part of Iran. Saddam Hussein was a legitimate threat to the Iranian regime. They're right next door. We're not. So we don't like what the Iranians are doing there. I think what they did to U.S. soldiers deserved more punishment than they received. But we really didn't do much to counter that. So we allowed a lot of that encroachment to take place. But keep in mind that Iraqis and Iranians are different. The Iraqis, both Sunni and Shia are in many cases nationalists. And while they may prefer to have Iranian support, the Shia are concerned about the Sunni threat, that doesn't mean that they're one and the same with the Iranian regime. And there were a lot of divisions there between Najaf and Qom and the religious, on the religious side of things, and socially and structurally, there are differences there too. So I've had this argument with some colleagues, and some of them are better on Iraqi history than I am. They argue that if the U.S. left, that eventually the Iraqi Shia would just push the Iranians out, and then eventually things would stabilize. I don't believe that to be true. I think they have too many national security interests in Iraq now. I think they're going to be there perpetually. I think this is status quo for them. And I also think they filled the vacuum that we left in 2011. So, you know, we can become politically relevant in Iraq again, and we can help to nudge Iranian interests back out again. The more we antagonize Iran, the more contentious that struggle is going to be if we do decide to go back in. It's not that we're not in Iraq now. We are there. We have an embassy there in Baghdad. We are supporting the military. We have troops on the ground, you know, all over the country. But we are not anywhere near the political, economic, or social or military presence that we were up through 2011. So there is a chance for the U.S. to do something there. We can turn this around. There are dividing lines in the Shia community. There are incredible, deep dividing lines there. And the Iranians are not a superpower. There's hope and there's opportunity.
And it sounds like the opportunity is going to be different than what we had the opportunity to fashion, you know, 6-7 years ago. So give me a final question for you, Ben, and I appreciate your time today. What are the next shoes that drop in this whole dance of what becomes of Iraq?
Kirkuk and the what happens after Mosul and Kirkuk, I think, are the two big ones. As you see, the Kirkuk is, you know, the Kurds now, for all intents and purposes, control the city, and they refuse to give it back. The Iraqi government has stated publicly that they are going to have Kirkuk back. There are other cities along the line there that are flashpoints. You could see the Iraqi government forces fighting against the KRG forces. That's both PUK and KRG. Right. That would be right. And KDP. That would be one. And then the other one is, if that road is formed, that bridge across Anbar province, you could start to see some Sunni Shia stuff going on in Anbar. Because there are now Shia militia there. Yeah.
Right. And a final short, quick question, and then I will let you go. We are doing a dance relative to Turkey in terms of arming the Iraqi Kurds. How does that all factor into this?
Well, it's not just Turkey. It's Turkey and Russia and the Assad regime and ISIL and the Iraqis and the Iraqi Kurds. It's a deep and complex mess that we have gotten ourselves into in northern Syria, and everybody is just kind of balancing right now, cutting deals. You're starting to see some Syrian folks who we were supporting going over to the Russians. The Russians and the Turks, their relationship ebbs and flows, and, you know, that could go south at any minute. It's a hot spot, and our folks are right there in the middle of it.
Clear as mud, Connor. This doesn't sound...
Don't fight a war without a plan. Have a plan, right? One of the first things you learn is a Marine, right?
Right. No, and often, right, the most important wars you fight are the ones you don't. But
that's true too.
But I'm not encouraged after talking to you. Should I be?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think we can change things for the better if we take action and take risk. And that is what is required. The problem, and I mentioned this, I think, the last time I spoke with you, every conversation I have with staffers and political people around the city here begins with a discussion of constraints and restraints. It begins with the thing, well, we can, you know, tell me what you think we should do, but within this box, that I've already created for you.
Right.
There's no ability to think big. There's no ability to conceptualize a new plan or to do something that entails risk. We have worked ourselves into a little corner where we are afraid to do anything bold or reverse ourselves and admit that we made some mistakes or to question our assumptions about the nature of warfare or strategy or the dynamics of the Middle East. That is exactly what is called for. We need to go back and reassess and question all of those assumptions and remember that we are the country that won World War II and put a man on the moon. We can do great things if we put our minds to it and if we're willing to take risk, and that the opportunities exist in Iraq, to a lesser extent in Syria, to make something better than we have now. And it means staying there. And we just have to get our heads around that.
Does your conversations with Ryan Crocker, does that enhance your hope? Does it make you feel better that we have the right people in place to fashion something like this?
I don't want to
venture
a comment on who's in place and who isn't, but I can tell you that working with a guy like Ryan Crocker, who's been in the region since the 1970s as a diplomat and put his heart and soul into making that a better part of the world, that he didn't give up hope, and that he wrote a report like the one he just published saying that we need to have a long-term strategy for Iraq and that there's hope and we should have optimism and that we should go back in and focus on political issues and reconciliation and economic support, that a guy like that hasn't become cynical has to give you some hope.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, I want to thank you for doing this. You've been a great friend of the program throughout the first year. Ben, and I want to wish you all continued success at RAND and all the different things. No small thing to be involved in the task force on the future of Iraq and breaking bread with guys like Ryan Crocker. So congratulations, Ben, and thank you for all the help you've been to us.
Mac, it's been a great experience, and again, congratulations on getting into your second year here. It's a great show.
Awesome. All right. Ben Conable, more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.